This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, the Titanic is just one of the many famous shipwrecks around the world. We'll talk to the author of a new book about the fascination we have with the Titanic and the culture of exploring sunken ships. Now, less than a week out from the final day of the midterm election, we're going to take a home stretch look at where things stand and what could shift the balance in closely contested Wisconsin races. You can join in at 800-642-1234. As a voter, have you already voted? Are you planning to vote on election day itself? What's the experience been like if you've already voted? What are you watching for? Is there a race you're focusing on in the state? What questions do you have for our guest about the races for governor and U.S. Senate? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Craig Gilbert is a Lubar Fellow at Marquette University Law School. He was previously the Washington Bureau Chief and National Reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel and has covered every presidential campaign since 1988. Craig, welcome back to Central Time.
It's great to be with you.
Well, something we've talked about here recently on Central Time, advertising in this race. I think the race for governor just hit record levels of spending. Does all that money, do you think, really make a difference?
Well, it can make a difference under certain circumstances. I mean, the classic situation is when one side heavily outspends another. It can make a difference. It can also make a difference when two sides are trying to define a challenger who's not well known or a lot less well known than the incumbent. It's easier to kind of affect public perceptions of a candidate who's less well-known than one who's already kind of firmly established in the public eye. So those are kind of two cases, but often the returns are really marginal. I mean, there's nothing more inefficient probably than campaign spending or campaign ad spending. Everybody does it because they get something out of it. And they're also worried if they don't do it, then the other side is going to have the airwaves to themselves. But it's not a lot of bang for the buck. Generally, it's not the most impactful thing in a campaign.
Well, those dollars might only sway a few voters, but only a few voters might make a difference. We're seeing the latest polling, including the Marquette Law School poll out yesterday, basically either tied or well within margin of error in both of our big statewide races for governor and U.S. Senator. What are your takeaways of the latest polling there?
So it's really striking, there's been a lot of discussion about the polling and whether the polls are accurate or not. We do have a recent history of the polls undercounting or understating Republican support in the last two presidential races, not so much in the last midterm. So that question is out there. But if you view both of these races as very, very close races, it's kind of an unprecedented situation in Wisconsin. We've had close presidential races. In fact, we've had four presidential races out of the last six have been decided by less than a point. But there's very little history of ultra-thin races for governor and ultra-thin races for Senate. And to have two of them on the same ballot is something we really haven't seen before, certainly haven't seen it in decades. So that, I think, is what stands out to me about this circumstance. And we can talk about the forces, we can talk about why that is, but we're certainly in a world, living in a world where in an evenly divided state like Wisconsin, there's not very much play in the electorate. Both sides are kind of, have their 47% that they can count on and they're battling over the rest. And so, we don't see the, generally don't see the 10 and 15 and 20 point margins you used to see in politics. And we see that we've seen from the start in these races that the movements, there are movements, but they're very small.
Comparing to like a 2018 where you had Governor Evers pulling it out by, or wasn't governor yet, but he won the race by about 1%. And then you had his Democratic colleague, Senator Tammy Baldwin, winning re-election, walking away, like a huge spread between those elections in Wisconsin terms. What happened there? Why don't you see it happening this time around with that spread?
Yeah, that was really kind of a special case in a couple of respects. I mean, for one, the governor's race was the closest governor's race in many decades. And on the other hand, you had, an 11-point difference or 10-point difference between Tony Evers' one-point victory for governor, one-point Democratic victory, and Tammy Baldwin's 11-point Democratic victory for the U.S. Senate. And I think that was a combination of Tammy Baldwin being an effective candidate, certainly someone who spent a lot of time traveling around the state. I think she was very effective in kind of running on Wisconsin issues, running on local issues, running on things like dairy and Buy American. And she also had an opponent, Leah Vukmir, who had not run for statewide office before, who didn't have the same level of funding and organization and experience. So in kind of modern terms, it was kind of a one-sided campaign. And it produced a really this odd circumstance of a double-digit victory in kind of a 50-50 state. And I think what we're seeing in this cycle is, you know, tons of money and effort being poured in on both sides in both races. You know, obviously both sides are running real campaigns. And so, you know, we're left with, you know, the campaigns are kind of reverting or exposing what is are these very even political divisions in the state. And this is kind of our state. It's a 51-49 state or a 50-50 state. And you don't have big advantages being brought to bear by either side that would open up these races beyond that.
Talking to Craig Gilbert, a longtime watcher of Wisconsin politics. It is a check-in before the midterms, which wrap up next week. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Whatever you watch, wherever you go, do you see lots of ads? Are you getting texts? Are ads showing up in your mail? You tired of them? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Craig, in a recent piece, you wrote about some questions that these elections might answer. One is turnout. Now, the stereotype is presidential years, you get big turnout, midterms, not so much. What's been happening lately in Wisconsin?
Yeah, so back in 2014, the turnout was 55% of voting age adults, and that was the highest turnout in decades. In 2018, it shot up to almost 60%, which was the highest turnout going all the way back to the Second World War, and maybe earlier for all I know, but our records only go back, my records only went back, go back to the late 40s. So it was only about 6 or 7 points smaller than the presidential turnout of 2016. So, you know, whereas in the past you'd have like a, you know, a 20 point difference between presidential turnout and midterm turnout, now you're talking about a 5 or, you know, a 10 or 8 point difference. Midterm turnout's looking more like presidential turnouts. And so the question, you know, we're left with this cycle is, are we going to get, I mean, it's a high bar to match 2018. That was a crazy turnout. It was a crazy turnout year nationally, and Wisconsin had the second highest turnout in the country in 2018 because it's a high turnout state and there was a lot at stake. And there's a huge amount at stake in this cycle. Wisconsin's one of a dwindling number of true battlegrounds. So it's getting a lot of national effort and attention. And you've got these two big, close, consequential races on the ballot. So the ingredients seem to be there for a really big turnout. We don't know what that means exactly for the outcome of these races, because higher turnout could mean, you know, higher Democratic turnout and normal Republican turnout. It could mean the opposite. It could mean that both sides are kind of maximizing on turnout. And what's going to decide these races is not so much which side is turning out more voters, but how a kind of shrinking slice of independent voters are voting.
You are also watching the gender gap in votes. What are you looking for?
Yeah, what I think some people are missing about the gender gap is that, you know, particularly in the wake of the Dobbs decision overturning, the Supreme Court overturning a right to an abortion, overturning the Roe v. Wade decision, there's been a lot of focus on how that's affecting female voters. But what we've seen in Wisconsin in recent years really is as the state has shifted from being, you know, a modest Democratic advantage in party identity to being a very marginal Republican advantage, that shift has occurred because of a shift among men toward the Republican Party. So, you know, the gender gap can be a problem for either party. It can be a problem for the Republican Party when they lose ground with women, and it can be a problem for the Democratic Party when they lose ground with men. Right now, I mean, if anything, I think it's a bigger problem for the Democratic Party, or has become as big or a bigger problem for the Democratic Party, because they've lost ground with male voters, particularly kind of white non-college male voters. And so, you know, what that bears watching in this cycle is again, in these races, whether the Democratic deficit among men is bigger or smaller than the Republican deficit among women.
We're talking to Craig Gilbert, former Washington bureau chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, now a fellow at Marquette University's Law School, with us taking a look at the home stretch in the midterm elections here in Wisconsin. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have for our guest? What are you watching for? What do you think is going to swing the election one way or another? Call in at 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk with Craig Gilbert, longtime national reporter, former Washington bureau chief at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, now a Lubar Fellow at Marquette University Law School, doing a final preview of the midterm election in Wisconsin. Early voting underway now. Final election day coming up Tuesday. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Steve is with us in Madison. Hi, Steve.
Yeah, hi. How's it going? Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, what did you want to ask about, Steve?
Well, what I've been wondering about is, you know, I heard your caller or your guest touch on the abortion issue, but there's always been sort of this idea in politics that there's this third rail of politics that politicians never want to touch, and that's Social Security and Medicare. And I'm wondering, does your guest see that as playing a role in the election that we're coming up here?
Gotcha, Gary. Steve, you're breaking up a little bit. But Craig, yeah, we had the head of the Republican Senatorial Reelection Committee saying, let's not get rid of Social Security or Medicare, but put it on the table, reevaluate it every few years, see if we need to make changes. Democrats have tried to make an issue of that. Is that something you think will be an issue?
Yeah, we've also had, you know, Republican Senator Ron Johnson from Wisconsin make comments about Social Security related to that. So it's an interesting question. And it's also been, you know, part of the kind of internal or maybe external debate about Democratic messaging. You know, Democrats are obviously facing some headwinds as the party in power in a midterm election with the economy performing the way it is. Joe Biden's numbers in kind of negative territory. And so you've got Democrats kind of arguing, I think, about how effective their own messaging has been. And one of those arguments I've heard is that, you know, people questioning whether the Democrats should be placing more emphasis or should have been placing more emphasis on that particular set of issues in going after Republicans. You know, it's a good question. I mean, it is, as the caller pointed out, you know, it is something that comes, you know, discussing changes to Social Security and Medicare comes with huge political risks. And I think you've seen kind of Democrats trying to weigh, you know, what they think this campaign should be about, to what degree it should be about abortion, to what degree it should be about Donald Trump and the threat they believe Republicans pose to the election system, to what degree it should be kind of the Democratic response on the economy, and to what degree it should be this issue, which is, you know, basically, you know, debating which party is going to protect Social Security and Medicare. So, you know, I'm always hesitant to sort of second guess campaigns because I'm not kind of sitting where they're sitting. I think it'll be an interesting postmortem question, depending on the outcome of these races, as to whether, you know, it would have been smart politically to place more emphasis on this issue. You are hearing Democrats hit that issue harder in the closing weeks of the campaign.
Thanks for that call, Steve. Nate joins us now in Milwaukee. Nate, hello.
Hi, thank you for having me. I early voted. One of the things I think about, and I think other voters should do, is who do they think will be best for the state 6 months after the election when all the ads, good or bad, are long gone? And one of the things that ads were potentially effective is hitting Mandela Barnes if the bail system that he supported was in place, the person who sadly killed a bunch of people in Waukesha would have actually been in jail because it would have been the risk to the community, and yet he was criticized for that. Looking at the governor's debate, which I already voted on, I think that Tony Evers both addressed the idea of helping local governments, which are facing problems now and will be in the future, And I'm worried that if Tim Michaels got elected, the rainy day fund would be gone and local governments would not be helped as much as they would be under Governor Ears, because the math that he did throw out during the debate doesn't add up with the budget.
Nate, thanks for the call. Craig, what do you think?
Well, you know, when you talk about the consequences of these elections, it's hard to even know where to start. I mean, it would be hard to envision a set of statewide elections that are, you know, in a midterm that are more consequential than these two. I mean, if you think about it on the Senate race side, the Senate is 50-50. So literally, you know, Wisconsin's Senate seat could be the difference between one party controlling the Senate and the other party controlling the Senate, which of course has massive implications when it comes to certainly the next 2 years of the Biden presidency and his, you know, ability to implement an agenda, get his nominations confirmed, and also setting up, you know, what it means for control of the Senate, you know, 2 years later and 2 years after that. And on the state side, you know, you have, you know, this certainty that Republicans will have a large majority in the legislature. So the difference between, you know, the divided government that we have today and having full Republican control of the government in Wisconsin is pretty profound. Whether you're a Democrat or Republican, it's a pretty profound difference, and also has national implications because Wisconsin is one of a handful of states that may determine the presidency in 2 years. And the outcome of this race for governor will have a big effect on the conduct, the rules, the administration of the election in 2024, and whether that election is disputed or not after it takes place. So it's just, I mean, we talk about the importance of every election, but and this may be another reason why we do see a robust turnout in 2022, is that you couldn't really draw a set of elections with more profound consequences, I think, for a state than these two.
Thanks for that call. That a quote from a Republican candidate, Tim Michaels, for governor got a lot of attention this week. In the midst of a campaign talk, he said, "Republicans will never lose another election in Wisconsin after I'm elected governor." A campaign spokesperson said later he was referring to the policies are going to be so good, Republicans won't lose. People worried about the future of elections are worried that, you know, that was a statement that he would make changes in the election system. How much is at stake in how we run elections in the state if Republicans then had that control of the legislature, very likely, and the governor's office?
Yeah, so, I mean, a lot could be at stake. And sometimes, you know, you can overstate the importance of some of these issues, some of the election disputes that we've had in the state. There's been running battles over the election rules in Wisconsin, you know, for several decades. And sometimes the battles are over pretty, mm-hmm. You know, the small print of election administration. Sometimes they're over exactly how long is the early voting window going to be, exactly what are the rules, you know, for absentee mail ballots. It can get pretty detailed, and these things are all important. They're not all existential. But the big, you know, the big questions are when you talk about election changes that might, you know, really hold down the vote by making it harder for people to vote. And more important than anything, when you talk about, you know, what happens in the event of a disputed election. And if you talk about scenarios where there's the possibility, as we saw, you know, in 2020, when there was an attempt to decertify or overturn the election, I mean, that's existential. And so, you know, we don't know exactly whether there would be a repeat of that in 2024. That's certainly obviously what has some Democrats very alarmed when, you know, given all the rhetoric on the Republican side about disputing the 2020 election and promises that Republicans are making to some people in their political base about how they're going to handle elections in the future, That has put, you know, that set of issues has, it has raised the profile of those issues and, you know, understandably made it a concern to a lot of voters.
Time for one more quick call from Gary in Greendale. Gary, hi.
Do you mean Glendale? Rob?
I guess so. I had Greendale, yeah. But I bet you're right. Glendale it is, Gary. Hi.
Okay. Thanks, Rob. Craig, one of the polls this week indicated that down the line, the favorability rating of Democratic candidates was much higher than those of the Trump Republican candidates. And my nephew disclosed this weekend, longtime Republican, he can't vote for Michaels. How much of an effect do you think will have people in Georgia who are longtime Republicans voting for Reverend Warnock rather than for Herschel Walker?
Oh, Gary, thanks. About half a minute for your thoughts. Republicans.
Yeah, so big question. We've seen, you know, obviously the fundamentals in this election in many ways are favorable to Republicans, but we've also seen issues surrounding some of the individual Republican candidates like Herschel Walker in Georgia and like Dr. Oz in Pennsylvania. So it sort of sets up this question as to whether their liabilities as candidates are enough to prevent them from winning otherwise winnable races for Republicans in what should be a good Republican year. So that's a big question nationally.
Gary, thanks for the call. And Craig, thanks for being with us.
Absolutely.
That's Craig Gilbert, longtime reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, now a Lubar Fellow at Marquette University Law School, with us for a look at the big questions about the elections here in Wisconsin. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, take an art tour with museums around the state sharing their collections, and you can tell us about your favorite place to go check out some art. That's coming up tomorrow morning at 8, and that's here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And you can get started on that conversation right now. Email ideas@wpr.org. If you want to send a shout out to your favorite art museum in Wisconsin or beyond, even if you work there, that's okay to put in a plug. Email Kate's team, ideas@wpr.org. That's ideas@wpr.org. Or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. That's coming up tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. We all grow up knowing that a cow says moo and a cat goes meow. And a few years back, there was an explosion of public interest in the question, what does the fox say? But here's a question, what sound does a turtle make? And hang on, does a turtle make a sound? The answer is yes, and now there are recordings to prove it. As reported by NPR, many turtle species were thought to be voiceless, or if they did make sounds, nobody knew about them. A couple of biologists teamed up, developed a hydrophone, an underwater microphone that would let them record sounds underwater. They tested turtles, tortoises, and some other species. They found that, yes, indeed, a lot of them do make sounds. You just got to listen. Here's a sample of a southern New Guinea giant softshell turtle. What do we call that sound? A turtle goes woo-woo? I don't know. And are these guys using sounds to communicate with each other? That's a whole other question. I got to get one of those hydrophones so I can do the show while I'm swimming. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. There have been a lot of shipwrecks in the course of human history, some famous, many more forgotten. Some of those wrecks, like the Lusitania, played a part in world history. Here in the Midwest, the wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald lives on in legend and song. But the Titanic looms large over the history of shipwrecks. In his new book, our next guest shares the story not just of the Titanic, but of the people who have obsessed over it, quested to find its remains, to bring them back up to the surface, even claimed to own the wreck. We're listening back to our conversation with him now, and you can get in touch by emailing ideas@wpr.org. Are you interested in shipwrecks? Just shipwreck curious? Do you have a wreck that's really captured your imagination? If you dive, have you ever gotten to see one up close? Are there stories that you hope could still be discovered? Let us know. Email ideas@wpr.org. That's ideas@wpr.org. Daniel Stone is an author on science and adventure and a senior editor for National Geographic. He's a former White House correspondent for Newsweek and The Daily Beast. His latest book is called Sinkable: Obsession, the Deep Sea, and the Shipwreck of the Titanic. We talked to him about it this summer. Here's a listen. Will you start off with a little quiz you give people? I know the answer already. I cheated. I read the book. You ask people how many shipwrecks they think there are out there in the seas. And I think I can guarantee anybody who's coming up with a number is probably too low. Can you give us a sense of the scope of shipwrecks?
Yeah, I've asked this question to hundreds of people over the past few years, and everyone is wrong. When we think of how many shipwrecks there are in the world, we usually think of the big ones, the Titanic, the Lusitania, as you mentioned. But we forget that for centuries, this is how people transported themselves and goods all over the world. And so the number, according to UNESCO, about 10 years ago, is actually 3 million shipwrecks in the oceans, lakes, and rivers all over the world.
Now, the Titanic, as you mentioned, gets a lot of the attention. And it wasn't, you write, the biggest or the deadliest shipwreck of all time. So what is it about the wreck of the Titanic that made it such a big thing that we're still talking about it to this day?
Well, you're right. There's almost nothing unique about the Titanic. I mean, ships had been built big before. There were a lot of ships for rich people that ferried people across the Atlantic. Even iceberg strikes were very common in the 1880s and 90s. They had actually started to decline around the time of the Titanic. So I kind of narrowed down on this theory that the reason the Titanic has so much lasting staying cultural power is this weird quirk of a ratio of numbers. We all know that about 1,500 people died on the Titanic, but also about 700 people lived. And those 700 were mostly young women and children who ended up living another 50, 60, 70 years telling and retelling the stories of that night. And storytelling is what keeps kind of the cultural lore of any event alive. And in that case, kept the Titanic alive enough to be reinvented in movies, books, and museum exhibits for more than a century.
Now, your book is not just about the Titanic, but about the people who've gotten obsessed with it over the years. Can we throw you in with that category? Was there something that just like got you so interested, obsessed with hearing these stories?
I have resisted being a shipwreck obsessive, but I think I am. I love these wrecks. There's so many around the world. I fixated on the Titanic since I was a boy, as most young people do. It's just a great story. I did my science project when I was in first grade on floating and sinking and figuring out why some things float and why they don't. I frankly still struggle to understand, you know, the viscosity of materials and how ships are built. It's an endless world of mystery and intrigue, especially when you get to old ships and wrecks carrying buried treasure and you know, races for lost shipwrecks. It really gets fascinating.
Talking to Daniel Stone, his new book is called Sinkable: Obsession, the Deep Sea, and the Shipwreck of the Titanic. You can join in if you share his curiosity about the Titanic and other shipwrecks. If you have a question to share, 800-642-1234 is the number to call. That's 800-642-1234. Dan, of course, I'd heard about the Titanic. I didn't really know about this world of people who, over the years, tried to find it. And once it was found, tried to bring it up. You talked to some of the people. Give us a sense of the scope from the like amateurs and maybe weirdos, we might say, to the professionals and all points in between. There's a lot of people who have done this stuff.
Yeah, almost immediately after the Titanic sank, there was this effort to try to find it and salvage it, raise it up. And, you know, for people in the early 20th century who had no experience doing this, this didn't seem that outlandish, right? There was one guy named Charles Smith in 1914, 2 years after the Titanic sank, who said, I'm just going to go to the wreck site, or I'm going to go to the site where it went down. I'm going to drop a few electromagnets in the water. They're going to attract themselves to the ship. They're going to attach themselves, and then we'll just pull them up as though it would be that easy. And the 20th century is filled with people like Charles Smith who start to imagine this goal. They think it's fascinating. They think there's a lot of fame and fortune to be gained for whoever finds and raises the Titanic. And they keep getting defeated. They have these wild plans of, you know, finding the ship and putting ping pong balls in the ship or foam that'll float it to the surface. And they keep getting pushed back, mostly because they're amateurs. You know, ship salvage is a real industry, but for people who just love wrecks, they don't have the equipment, the knowledge, and the experience really to pull up a ship, let alone one as big as the Titanic, 2.5 miles deep.
Now, you had kind of an obsession trying to meet the man who owned the wreck of the Titanic, or at least told the world that he owned it. Can you tell us a little bit about him?
Yeah, this is a funny story of the Titanic, and this man, his name's Doug Woolley, is the central character of my book, very colorful character, who basically decides as a young boy in the 1940s that he wants to own the Titanic that's underwater. And he goes through this elaborate legal process when he becomes a young man, and he puts ads in newspapers, and eventually he gets to a point where nobody objects. You know, the wreck is underwater. Nobody knows where it is. No one's going to fight him on it. And so he spends most of the 60s, 70s, and 1980s claiming that he owns the wreck. And he plans to go find it. He plans to corral a team together to go salvage it. And this is written up in newspapers all over the world, in every country, as this man who owns the wreck. And Doug Woolley is still alive. He's 86, lives in England. I went to visit him. He still thinks it's possible. And I kind of realized that this was the North Star of his life. And the Titanic was something he really wanted to go save. But at almost every point of his life, the Titanic kept reinventing Doug Woolley and saving his life instead.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Brian is with us in Madison. Brian, hello.
Hi, this is a great topic. I have my 9-year-old son has been obsessed with the Titanic for at least 2 years. He has a poster and Legos with a really awesome Titanic ship. There's so many unbelievable stories about that tragedy. I don't know if they're actually true. Like, one was there was a, you know, sailor who was told at the last minute not to go, but he had the key to the room where the lookout people would have normally been able to see the iceberg with the binoculars, but the door, the room was locked with the binoculars that they normally would have used. And that's why they didn't see it sooner. And my son has these I Survived book series about natural or historical tragedies that occur throughout the world. And this whole thing, he's been a huge history buff, but the Titanic really was the thing that jump-started his interest in history.
Interesting, Brian. A couple of things there, Daniel. First of all, that legend. There are lots of legends about the Titanic. You were just talking about Doug Woolley. He had a family legend that he had a couple of relatives who, at the last minute, had a premonition that something bad was going to happen, didn't get on the ship. I don't think that was confirmed. There's a lot of these stories out there.
Yeah, almost endless stories. I haven't heard that specific one about the binoculars. It sounds like something that would have happened aboard the Titanic. But to your caller's point, I mean, the amount of folklore and urban legends that sometimes are facts, sometimes not, but inspire this next generation. I mean, a 9-year-old today was not even alive at the 100th anniversary of the Titanic, and is still deeply inspired. That's beautiful, and kind of speaks to his sense of history and putting himself in its place.
Brian, thanks for that call. We're talking to National Geographic senior editor Daniel Stone. His new book is called Sinkable: Obsession, the Deep Sea, and the Shipwreck of the Titanic. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about shipwrecks? Why ships sink? What happens when they do? Are you personally curious, like our caller's kid was, about shipwrecks? Is there one that intrigues you in particular? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with National Geographic senior editor Daniel Stone about his new book, Sinkable: Obsession, the Deep Sea, and the Shipwreck of the Titanic. You can join in with your questions, your own shipwreck curiosities, Titanic or otherwise, at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Nancy is with us in Milwaukee. Nancy, hi.
Hello. I was intrigued many years ago after reading a book about the fact that gold heavily laden on ships was, of course, very highly prized, and there wasn't really a good way to get it from California during the gold rush to the New York banks. The only way that it could be shipped was to go around the tip of South America and then up all the way up the coastline, all the way to New York, and that the building of the Panama Canal was really because of the ease of transportation of gold. And I thought maybe you would be interested in that, because so many ships laden heavily with gold have been found all along the South American coastline on the east and west sides, and, of course, along the whole eastern seaboard. The building of the Panama Canal was so important for the transportation of gold.
Interesting. Nancy, thanks a lot for the call. And then you reference there's a lot of gold, or has been over the years, from not just the California gold rush, but from the Spanish galleons taking gold across one ocean or another.
Yeah, especially, Rob, down by the coast of Florida is often called the Treasure Coast, from those specific two eras, the gold rush and one very large wreck that sank there in 1857 called the SS Central America, often called the Ship of Gold. And then all of the Spanish ships that were in Central and South America during the period of colonization, you know, getting and pilfering as much as they could, and they'd bring that treasure up along the coast of Florida and often get caught in storms. And so one of the most valuable shipwrecks ever found, the Nuestra Señora de Atocha, went down right around Florida. It was found in the 1970s with several hundred million dollars of gold on board. And it's believed there's many galleons still out there, many in those waters.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Cody joins us now in Chautauqua. Cody, hello.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Cody?
So I was just curious, when it comes to shipwrecks, when a ship goes down, is it like a free-for-all for whoever wants to go explore it can go down there and maybe grab stuff or see what's going on with it? Or are there laws that prohibit people from going there and like disrupting it from where its resting place is? Because not only with the Titanic, but another one that I'm familiar with and I follow a lot with the history of is the Edmund Fitzgerald. And I was just curious as is to if people are not allowed to bother with it where it sits at the bottom of the lake or the ocean floor.
Cody, thanks a lot for that call. You wrote something to the effect of, Dan, the most important piece of technology for somebody looking for shipwrecks is a really good legal team.
Exactly. And this is a great question from Cody that has a kind of a long answer. I'll give a short one, which is ships are subject to very weird legal parameters, right? Ships can be built in one country, sail to another country, be carrying goods from a third country, holding people of different citizenships and nationalities. So the jurisdiction over a ship when it goes down can get very complicated very quickly. The Edmund Fitzgerald, on account of being fairly contained within the U.S. In the Great Lakes, is kind of a no-brainer and very easy. But when a ship like the Titanic goes down, or another one that's holding gold, you know, in the middle of the ocean, you often see these big races among countries to prove that they had claim over the ship and the contents of it. But often these things get very legally thorny, and the best way to go for a ship is to choose one that's old, because when it's old, the insurers, the owners, the passengers, the families, everyone has mostly died. And those are the ships that are most often given or granted to the people who find them.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Talking to Daniel Stone, author of the new book, Sinkable, Obsession, the Deep Sea, and the Shipwreck of the Titanic. Still time for your calls at 800-642-1234. Margaret joins us now in Franklin. Margaret, hi.
Hi. Hi, Rob. How are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Margaret?
Well, it's such a wonderful show. I'm so excited because my grandson has been so interested in the Titanic, and just as the previous gentleman called and said his son was, he's been reading all the I Survived books, and I don't know where he got the interest from, but he is going on vacation with his family down to Tennessee, and from what they're telling me, there is a museum down there regarding the sinking and everything about the Titanic. So that sounded really interesting. He has to go see it. And I read a book some years ago called The Christmas Tree Ship, about the ship that used to haul Christmas trees from up north. Lake Michigan shore down to Chicago in the 1800s, so people down there could have Christmas trees, live Christmas trees, and it sunk off of two rivers.
Yeah. Margaret, thanks for the call. We've talked about the Christmas tree ship on the show in the past. She mentioned that museum in Tennessee. A few different places have built, mostly on dry land, replicas of some or all of the Titanic, Dan.
Yeah, in Tennessee, actually in Pigeon Forge, there is a half-scale replica of the half of the Titanic, which is great to visit, especially for young people to see the ship up close. There's also one in Branson, Missouri. The first full-scale replica of the full Titanic is currently being built in a province in western China at the moment. One thing I learned while reading and learning about the Titanic is that the Titanic story is especially big in China for reasons I still don't know. But the movies, all of the James Cameron movie and many of the movies that have been made in, about the Titanic do especially well in China. And they love this story there and can't get enough.
Thanks for the call, Margaret. PJ joins us now in Appleton. PJ, hi.
Hi. Back in the 70s, when I was in high school, my brother was fireman, oiler, water tender, shipping out of the Merchant Marine and to Russia, a lot of different places. But at one point, he was shipping out on ore boats in the Great Lakes. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, at that same time, they came out with that song that you've mentioned the boat and the ship and the song, and my mama couldn't listen to it. We'd have to turn the radio off when that one came on.
PJ, thanks so much for sharing that. And that brings me to something I wanted to bring up, Dan, that I took away from your book. You know, nowadays we might go on a cruise on a ship for fun. Our biggest worry might be our blood sugar from the sweet drinks on it or whatever. Through most of history, up to pretty recently, going to sea is really dangerous.
Yeah, I mean, this was an extremely deadly way to travel, and really the only way to travel to another country for almost all of human history. And we have stories of people who made it across oceans, right, like Columbus or Da Gama, but we forget the many, many millions of people who died on ships. And so it's only recently, and it's kind of a sign of the technology of our modern era, that when we think of relaxing or having a vacation, we think of going on large boats, in some cases through the same waters where some of the biggest shipwreck accidents have been through history. And we don't really think much of it. And I will say that that's, you know, kind of a triumph of technology. And it's also, it doesn't happen very often that we see these accidents anymore. We still have accidents of cruise ships and container ships much less often and much less deadly.
Now, here's you also look into the sort of the physics and mechanics of a shipwreck. And here's something that struck me, right? I think of a ship like the Titanic slowly settling down to the ocean floor. Wrong. Like 30 mile per hour impact. Did I read that right?
Yeah. Yeah. The Titanic split in half on the surface, and the bow fell a lot faster, almost like a missile, 30 miles an hour. Scientists have figured this out by looking at the current wreck site and reverse engineering how everything got where it was. But yeah, once a ship, which is of course lighter than the water it displaces, that's what helps it float. Once it takes on water, it becomes heavier, and it can become a lot heavier than the water. And when it has a trajectory of 2 miles or more, like the Titanic to sink, its terminal velocity could be as high as 30 or even more miles per hour.
All right, I got to ask, after spending years pursuing the stories of shipwrecks, are you more or less likely to want to spend time on a boat at sea?
Oh, I get horribly, horribly seasick. I can't even be on a kayak or canoe. And one of my great fears of writing this book is, you know, to become a shipwreck expert and invited on cruises to talk about it and just, you know, reveal my extreme antipathy to ships. I love ships. I just can't handle being on them.
No offense. If I operate a cruise ship line, I'm probably not going to invite the shipwreck author.
There you go. Exactly.
Dan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob.
Daniel Stone is an author on science and adventure, senior editor for National Geographic. Talk to him in August about his book, Sinkable: Obsession, the Deep Sea, and the Shipwreck of the Titanic. You can still let us know what shipwreck you're most curious about, or if there's a story that you found super interesting, or if you've dived down and explored one yourself. You can email ideas@wpr.org. That's ideas@wpr.org. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, polarization and extreme politics are on the rise. But Amanda Ripley is back with us to say we can still fix things, and we've only barely started to try. Plus, it's this week's edition of Food Friday. Making our own pasta may sound complicated to me, but a cookbook author tells us it can be easier and more delicious than we think. That's tomorrow here on Central Time.